sudden, you think they're foes, they're in business together. Danny Bush knows the Carlyle Group since years before, been raking in billions and itching for more.
It's blood for oil, we know there's a link.
They say code war,
we say code pink.
It's blood for oil, we know there's a link. They say code war,
we say code pink.
Code pink for freedom, code pink for peace, code pink till hunger. Was not Iraq, but Iran.
They feed you lies, don't want you to think.
They say code terror,
we say code pink.
They feed you lies, don't want you to think.
They say code terror, we say code pink. Code pink.
That was Code Pink by Emma's Revolution. I'm Jasmine, here with Code Pink. Welcome to our Code Pink radio show, presented by WBAI in New York City, WPFW 89.3 FM in Washington, D.C., KPFT 90.1 FM in Houston, KPFK 90.7 FM Los Angeles, and many other community radio stations like Western Mass Community Broadcasting, WMCBLP 107.9 FM. We're also on Spotify and Apple Podcasts. Check out our website at www.codepink.org/radio, where you will find all of our episodes from episode 1 to our most recent. It's the second week of January 2024, in the 14th week of Israel's incessant attacks on Gaza. Over 23,000 people have been killed by Israeli shelling and bombing, and thousands more are at risk of starvation and disease as Gaza continues to be cut off from most aid. Now that South Africa has invoked the ICJ proceedings, the world turns to the International Court in anticipation of the outcome. Whether Israel will face legal repercussions for its ongoing crimes is still unclear. Palestinians living under siege need our continued action and attention today until an unconditional, permanent ceasefire is reached and Palestine is liberated. Today, we'll hear from a current medical student and a recent law graduate here in the U.S. about how the global medical and legal professions have responded to the genocide in Palestine and what a path forward looks like. Today, we'll be chatting with Janann, a recent law graduate and practicing lawyer. Janann gained media attention in 2023 after her job offer from Foley and Lardner LLP was rescinded over her support for Palestinian rights on social media. Since then, Janann has continued to be outspoken about Palestine and is joining us today to discuss the legal profession and how it's implicated. So thank you so much for joining us, Janann. I'd love if you
thank you for having me.
Start off with a little about yourself if you'd like to share.
Yeah, for sure. Again, my name is Janann. I was born and raised in Chicago, specifically Little Palestine. And I say that because it had a huge impact on the way I was raised, what I felt passionate about, and just my how I got to the legal field in general, the decisions that I made to be involved and to speak up for Palestinian rights. I went to Georgetown Law for law school, like you mentioned. And yeah, for me, it's never been really a question for me whether I should speak up for Palestinian rights, but mostly a reality, especially growing up in Chicago in the Southwest suburbs. You're exposed to so many different injustices, right? From the healthcare system to poverty to police brutality to the immigration system. So I knew at a very young age that I wanted to create some kind of change through the law, but I didn't know that change would be that would lead to my firing, which we can discuss a little bit later.
Yeah, thank you so much. I really love hearing people's background stories, just like you, for so many of us. It isn't just a moment of crisis that brings us into awareness. It's that we grew up around these communities and these peoples outside of moments of crisis and have such deep ties. So we're super glad to hear from you today. And we can jump right in. So definitely the first thing I wanted to hear from you about is, you know, now that you're a practicing lawyer, you've gone through law school, you know, you're part of the legal community. What do you see as the responsibility or the role of global legal professionals when it comes to holding Israel accountable for its crimes? And do you believe accountability is possible or likely within the legal apparatus as it currently stands?
Yeah, I think that's a really important question. And at first, it begs us to change the framework of what law is and what it's supposed to be. The law is literally man's moral order, right? It's set to create boundaries for people, like what is right and wrong, literally like our written moral order. And I think right when you enter the law field and once you study the law and just like are immersed in this field, you realize that law field is actually a very anti-Palestinian field. And not only anti-Palestinian, but it's you could tell that it's built to uphold a certain demographic of people and really the people who have power, right? When you even look at the criminal justice system, the immigration system, and the way it functions, it's really just to keep I guess these classes that we've created in our society in place. So what do we do? I think for me, I went in with like butterfly feelings of like, I'm going to create a change through the law. And then you realize that like this law that we're studying and we're practicing and we're meant to uphold, in the end of the day, like a lot of it doesn't, it's a conflicting with our like our moral order and what I believe and my values. So what does that mean for us as lawyers? I think especially in this time, it really has become such a duty for us to set precedents and not only to speak up, right? Because I think speaking up, people can just tweet something and think they've done their job. But really what I'm trying to say here that as lawyers, it's so important for us to fill in the gap. Because again, the law has created man's moral order, but it seems like, and we've especially seen this in the past 3 months, of what man's moral order is whatever Israel says it's going to be, right? That killing over 30,000 people is justified, or the lack of freedom of speech in the United States is justified, or funding genocide that the US actually sends $3.8 billion to Israel is justified. And even just a few months ago, right, the Senate passing a resolution that condemns Students for Justice in Palestine as a terrorist organization, which, as we know, SJP has a long history of civil and nonviolent discourse. So, how are we taking all these things and understanding that? At this point, it is so important for people in the legal profession who are entrenched in the one field right now that is responsible for upholding this genocide and this intense repression against students, employees, and workers, that it's about filling in the gap. So, what do I mean by that? I think right now, what we're seeing is this awakening in the legal field that it's not only about speaking up, about, contacting your human resources, say, how are we supporting Arabs and Palestinians at work? How are we providing mental health resources? It could be something as small as that, or even taking it to a next level, asking your firm what their stance is on Palestine, or even just providing support to students that have gotten their offers rescinded, law students, people that have been fired. There's so much that is needed right now in the legal field that what is required of legal professions, and this is even to myself first and foremost, is to look at your surroundings. What is the gap in your work? Like, what is the gap in your fields right now? And what are skills, experience, and passions that you have at your disposal that can help fill in those gaps? And again, what we've learned from these past 3 months is that the most effective method is a bottom-up approach, right? We're not going to these CEOs of Foley and Lardner and all of that stuff and asking them to change their views and come out with a statement. No, but what's been most effective is people power, right? People that are working in firms, people that are just also outside the legal field, putting pressure, coming together as a unified front. Like that's how we create change. And I think setting this precedent that lawyers within the legal field are not going to be complicit to this genocide or any other injustice, and we are going to make a real effort to mold the legal field into what we want it to be in our vision of the future.
Wow, I really love that in so many ways, especially one, your reminder of like taking a historical approach, like the fact that legality has always been shaped over time. Legality of Israel's occupation has been shaped over time. Legality of the 75 years of occupation, not just beginning on October 7th, has been shifted over time. So reminding us how important it is to be historical and also to find what we can be doing now. I always love reminders like you just mentioned of filling in the gap wherever you are, wherever you work. Because there's always something that you could be doing in some way that you could be pushing these institutions, not from the top, like you said, not necessarily expecting Zionists and those with so much to lose in the current system to shift, but people power, right? I really appreciate that. But again, you're someone who's experienced that political repression firsthand a few months ago when you had your offer revoked by Foley and Lardner. So I'd love to maybe hear. Hopefully you've had time to personally process that opportunity loss, right? Not to, I know you didn't necessarily go into your activism expecting that to happen, but I'd also love to hear from you on how these institutions and law practices do the bidding of Zionism and what happens when political repression becomes the norm for even speaking out in solidarity on social media.
Yeah, exactly. I've have been processing, and it's actually like just today it's been difficult because obviously you're dealing with like the mourning of what's happening in Gaza and organizing at the same time. And then today I was like, I also need to find a job. So just dealing with those things I think has been difficult to navigate. But I think in terms of the repression that like I face and many others, it really goes to I think the core of the Zionist movement and agenda of they are more afraid than ever, right? This increased repression that we are seeing against students, employees, even people in media, journalists, is as a result of the fact that they know that they've lost control of the narrative. At the end of the day, there was actually a leaked meeting by from the Anti-Defamation League director Jonathan Greenwald, and he said, "We have a huge generational problem." He said, in all the polling he's seen, support for Palestine is not limited to a certain background or identity or even class. Like, it's really an entire generation that has woken up for Palestine. So I want to preface whenever I share my story that it's not meant to scare people or to feel make us feel weak or that we're losing, but actually as a strong point that this, they have made been so fearful of just me simply organizing that it's led to this intense repression. And I think when it comes to how institutions, corporations, and law practices, even here, have done the bidding of Zionism, I think it even goes back to simple things of in that meeting. So I was called into a meeting by the head partners at Foley and Lardner, and I kid you not, I spent almost 20 minutes describing to them what is happening in Gaza, like how Gaza is a literally 25-mile open-air prison with 2 million people, most highly densely placed in the world, that has been through siege after siege after siege. I explained to them that this siege has led to the death of, right now, we're almost at 12,000 or more children that have been massacred by Israeli airstrikes. I explained to them just like the occupation, how we have to view it in like a historical landscape as well, and what this means for the Palestinian people, and just that this is a genocide. Like, it's literally just a genocide. It's the most recorded genocide in history. And after spending 20 minutes just trying to educate them, they looked at me and asked me if I condemn the October 7th attacks. And it just goes to show this like blind, I think, I actually don't know how to phrase it, but this blind repression of like nothing else matters except repressing this person and framing them as the other, as the terrorist. So when it comes to these institutions doing Zionist bidding, it even goes back to, again, repressing people that are speaking out for Palestine, vilifying them, isolating them, instilling fear in them. Something that's so important to emphasize is that these extreme repressive tactics, their only goal in the Zionist agenda is to isolate people and to make the intense still fear in them. Fear in them so they don't speak out and isolate them and that they feel like they have no support, nobody to turn to. But in my case, when this happened to me, the overwhelming support of people that have had my back literally overshadowed any fear, any hesitation, any kind of anxiety that I had. So honestly, we are beating them at their own game through love and support at the end of the day.
Yeah, absolutely. And I really appreciate you mentioning that this is the most documented genocide in history because, you're trying to come up with the words, and what I'm coming up with is like a willful ignorance on the part of
Exactly, yeah.
corporations. They have access to just as much information as we do. They have access to the facts. They have access to all of the violent media repeals after they've like put out like terrible propaganda and lies. They have access to that same information, but they get to hide behind corporate, propaganda and kind of respectability and put the weight onto us individuals, export the weight onto us. Oh, we have to fire you because, you're not aligning with the apolitical mission of our organization. But it's a really like violent, like slow violent, I believe, in some ways. This like the way corporations get to have their hand heavy into the money pot and into the side of things that, benefits them. But when it comes to actually supporting individuals for simply speaking up against a genocide, it's like, oh, hands off. Do you condemn October 7th? And it's like, what are we doing here?
Yeah, exactly. And this is something I mentioned in the meeting that speaking up for Palestine is not just a political opinion. For me and many others, it's deeply embedded in my identity as someone who has family in the region. So, for them to vilify and target the only Arab, visibly Arab Muslim associate in the entire Chicago office, I'm literally the only person who wears hijab, and as Arab and Muslim descent and background. is extremely problematic, and honestly, it's a racist smear. The questions that they were asking and the way that they framed it.
Yeah, absolutely. And yet, after all of this, you've continued to be vocal, and you've continued to not stand down. Like you said, it is not a matter of politics. It is not a matter of just your job. It is about identity. It is about people. It is about Palestinian liberation. So, in mentioning how corporations have pushed back and mentioning we've seen what's happening all around the country and around the world in terms of different types of repression, but we're also learning so much about risk and solidarity. So I'd love to hear from you, after losing your job, but yet continuing to be a dedicated organizer, continuing to push and to learn and to push others. What have you learned about risk and solidarity or about the responsibility of all of those in general in the US?
Yeah, this is a great question. I think first I want to outline the risk part of it. I knew the risk that I was doing when organizing even before I got fired, and it was a surprise because I didn't realize the extent of that, but I did know the risk, and that was a risk I was willing to take. But I do want to emphasize to the audience and everybody that was watching, if you're organizing for Palestine, you're speaking out, and but you don't want to get fired, there are ways to get to protect yourself as well without getting fired. There's a way to speak up for Palestine while being strategic. So I think I want to emphasize that also Palestine has become mainstream. Just because you speak up for Palestine does not mean that you're going to get fired. It's actually been a rare case. In my case, it is one of the rarities, just because of how outspoken I was. So I do want to emphasize that this is not meant to instill fear, that speaking out for Palestine has become mainstream. And even doing that, there is a strategy and ways to be strategic to protect yourself. The second thing I would say, honestly, when this happened, I was devastated. I took like I think a day or two to process, but then literally 3 days later, I was protesting outside of Woodward, which is a weapons manufacturing company for Israel. It's really like it's not even a question. Like I didn't even think about, oh, like maybe let me stay silent or wait until this all blows over to get active again, because truly, like we have nothing to lose. Like there is no time to wait at all. And this is something that honestly gets me emotional every time I talk about, but the children and the people in Gaza are some of the most beautiful children I've ever seen. In the way they speak, laugh, present themselves, and their will and their strength and their love for each other and just the world and the people in general, they are the most beautiful people in the world, and we are losing them by the thousands. So when people ask me to like take it easy, wait until it blows over. Until what blows over? Like I think there was a statistic today that every 10 minutes a child in Gaza loses their limb. So there is absolutely no time to wait. And this is something that I really want to emphasize, that if you haven't spoken up for Palestine now, if you haven't done anything for Palestine now, then I want to be honest, like it's a lost cause. Like I don't even want to like convince you later on to like, oh, this is you have to speak up, because this is the time. If there was ever a time to be courageous, to be bold for Palestine, it's right now, because Palestinians need us right now to stop this genocide, to save countless lives. So again, this is not meant to shame anyone. I truly don't. I understand people have different circumstances, but I do want to emphasize that this time calls for something much greater than us, and to stand against genocide in whatever shape or form that looks like for you.
Yeah, absolutely. I really appreciate that, especially the reminder that when we say that our liberation is connected, we mean that so severely. If Palestine is
Exactly.
not free, then we are not free, and therefore we don't have anything to lose, right? There is so much to be learned from the faith and the strength and the perseverance of Palestinian children, of all Palestinian people right now, and not to, idolize martyrs and not to turn the loss that they never should have had to endure into something, beautiful for the rest of us. But I absolutely agree that like our risk and our solidarity here is nothing compared to what folks they are living every single day. So it's our minimum duty, our very bare minimum duty. If you claim to care about people, if you claim to care about liberation, if you claim to care about children anywhere in the world, that's the bare minimum right now. So I really appreciate that. And while we have you here, Jeanette, I'd love to use these last few minutes to shift and pick your legal brain just a little bit. So, of course, right now everyone is turning their attention to South Africa now that they have invoked the ICJ proceedings. And so the world is watching to see if the International Court will somehow do right by Palestinians. So I'd love to hear what are your hopes or expectations for the ICJ trial? And do you have any ideas or hopes for legal accountability for Zionists in Israel or for those in the US? I know we've been talking a lot about What does dangerous Zionist propaganda do here? We've
Yeah.
lost 6-year-old Wadia in Chicago. We've had multiple college students shot in Vermont. We've had so many arrests, so much repression. So what, as we are finally entering the legal arena for this ongoing genocide, what might that look like?
Yeah, for sure. I think honestly, the international law community has failed us for the past 3 months, but this case against Israel and committing genocide, the South African government has filed, is actually, I think, a ray of hope in holding Israel accountable. And people keep asking me, like, what is the point of this? What does this mean? So I do want to clarify that what this means is that simply Israel can no longer commit these acts of genocide in impunity or without accountability. For Israel to bomb hospitals, murder 111 journalists, bomb the capital of another country, Lebanon, Beirut was just bombed last week without impunity is absolutely ridiculous. So I think this will set a precedent that these crimes cannot be committed without accountability by the international community, and will also open the door to hold individuals that are responsible for this genocide accountable as well in the Israeli government. So I think, again, what does this mean? I actually am very hopeful that South Africa will win an order against Israel to cease and desist all acts of genocide against Palestinians, because again, this is the most documented genocide in history. And even under Article 1 of the Genocide Convention, all contracting parties will then be obliged, which is 153 countries, to prevent the genocide against Palestinians, if South Africa wins this case. So when the World Court, the International Court of Justice, again, gives this determination, as we hope, to stand by justice and to hold those who have committed genocide accountable, this also implicates the Biden administration, right? The Biden administration will also be condemned under Article 3, Paragraph E, that criticizes the complicity in Israel. So anybody that is complicit in this genocide, which, as we know, Biden himself is complicit in refusing to call for a ceasefire, but not only that, aiding this genocide in the past couple of months, continuously giving more funds and military weapons to Israel to carry out this genocide. So not only hold Israel accountable in committing genocide, but also those who are complicit, such as the United States. And I think when it comes to Wadih al-Fayoumi, I've talked about this in so many different like interviews and meetings, but what happens in politics, international law, has domestic and real world implications for everyday Palestinians. When we say that the murder of 30,000 Palestinians is up for debate and a ceasefire is up for debate, we have essentially subjected Palestinians saying that their life is not valuable and that they are the threat. They are the other. So that even happens with Wadih al-Fayoumi, that he was a 6-year-old boy stabbed 26 times. That is an inhumane, like a totally loss of humanity of the Palestinian people. So setting this precedent, saying that no, Palestinian and Arab life is valuable, you cannot indiscriminately massacre them without accountability, will have real world effects domestically, and will hopefully get ahead of this rhetoric that we demand accountability for not only Palestinians in Gaza, but also Palestinians and Arabs here who have been affected as well.
Wow, I really appreciate that clarification. I think our listeners will appreciate that as well, because so much of the question is we recognize that it's not just Israel, it's not just the IDF, it's not just Netanyahu, it's so many folks who are responsible, including and especially Biden. So it's really hopeful for folks to see that there is some possibility that even the United States, for funding such war crimes, could see some sort of accountability. And it's a really great point for folks to consider organize around. So thank you so much again, Janann. We've learned so much from you today. I know you're probably super, super busy organizing Chicago and being the great legal professional you are. We've learned so much from you. Thank you for taking time to chat with us. And we hope to connect with you soon. Where might folks who are interested in following you or your work find you online?
You could find me on Instagram at Jinan Shahade. That's JinanCheHadE. Again, JinanCheHadE. Thank you
Awesome.
all so much for listening.
Thank you.
That was Janann, and you're listening to Code Pink Radio, coming to you through Pacifica Radio's WPFW in Washington, D.C., WBAI in New York City, KPFT in Houston, and KPFK 90.7 FM, Los Angeles.
We'll be back after this break to hear from a current medical student about the ongoing Palestine genocide.
Don't you know, we're talking about a revolution sounds like a whisper. Don't you know, we're talking about a revolution sounds like a whisper. While they're standing in the welfare lines, crying at the doorsteps of those armies of salvation, wasting time in the unemployment lines, sitting around waiting for a promotion. Don't you know, talking about a revolution sounds whisper. Who are people gonna rise up and get their share? People gonna rise up and take what's theirs. Don't you know you better run, 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 run. Oh, I said you better run, 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 run. Cause finally the tables are starting to turn. Talking about the revolution.
That was Tracy Chapman's Talking About a Revolution, because we'll never stop talking about Palestine until it's free. Welcome back to Code Pink Radio. I'm Jasmine here with Code Pink, and you're listening to Code Pink Radio, presented by WBAI in New York City, WPFW in Washington, D.C., KPFT in Houston, and KPFK 90.7 FM Los Angeles. Next up, we'll be chatting with Bilal, an American medical student and protest medic, about the dire conditions of doctors in Gaza and how global medical professions ought to respond.
Thanks for joining us.
Hi, Jasmine. Thanks for having me. Really appreciate you inviting me to speak with y'all. Appreciate the work Code Pink does, of course.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate that a lot. And so obviously you are a medical student here in the US South, and you are well aware of the situation in Gaza over the last few months, the ongoing genocide, and you've been active as possible with your schedule. You frequently attend protests, you're frequently engaging in conversations with people about Gaza, about liberation. So I'd love to hear a bit about how that might have reflected in how you think about your future career. So how have your expectations or reflection on your medical career shifted in recent months as we've collectively witnessed what's happening with the doctors on the front lines in Gaza?
That's a great question. That's a huge question. I think where I start when I think about how the ongoing genocide in Gaza has, you know, shaped my perception of the medical profession in my career is first just being, you know, seeing the extent of the attacks on Gaza's healthcare system, from the arrests of doctors and nurses, the targeting of ambulances that are on the way to the hospital bombings themselves. I think one of the moments that sticks out most to me from those first few months after October 7th was the Al Ahli hospital bombing. And, you know, that's in the aftermath of that, that's when a bunch of physicians did a press conference, you know, surrounded by bodies. And to me, that was one of the most harrowing moments that I recall. And it was crazy because I had an exam the next day. I had a final exam the next day for one of my classes. And I just, you know, I heard about that. I saw some of the videos. I saw the press conference and I just was breaking down. And I, you know, part of me was in the way that we all feel, you know, wondering how can we all as a society continue to go on as this is happening. But I think moments like those increasing and other attacks on hospitals have led a lot of people like myself and my colleagues who are in the health professions to reflect on, you know, just the dire conditions in Gaza, right? Like, I'm a medical student, so I'm still learning the ropes, but it feels like there has to be so much that goes right for a clinical encounter to be successful, for me to feel like I've made a patient feel comfortable, that I've treated them well and whatnot. And hearing these stories about physicians operating on the floor, you know, using cell phone lights without anesthesia, it's just something that's unimaginable to me. And so that's the first part, you know, is just seeing the attack on healthcare, the healthcare system in Gaza and on medical professionals is, you know, I think a wake-up call for all of us who are health professionals outside of Gaza. And you know, it should really be a rallying cry for us to stand against the genocide in Gaza. But then on top of that, you know, just seeing this go on and seeing how few health professionals are standing up and taking a stand is also something that's really disappointing. You know, I think the medical profession tries to position itself as something apolitical, but in positioning itself as apolitical, it actually positions itself as very conservative, right? We're told to be professional. We're told to not take stances on certain things. And I understand in some ways why that comes up, right? There's this like idea that as physicians, we have to adhere to certain standards of professionalism. And that's really important in terms of respecting patients' autonomy, making patients feel comfortable. But at the same time, you know, there are moments in history where we have to leverage our positions of power to take a stand against things like genocide. And the fact that so many physicians have been punished, or so many Muslim physicians have been doxxed for taking a stand on what's happening in Gaza is really scary. So it's also led me to think about my future. You know, when I consider like what kind of healthcare system do I want to work in the future? You know, I want to be able to be with people. I want to be able to stand with people, working people, you know, the oppressed, the wretched of the earth and whatnot. And I don't want to be in a position where I can't speak out against something that I think physicians really have an obligation to speak out against. So it's also led me to think a lot about, you know, the limits of being a medical student and the limits of being a medical professional in the US in a very for-profit healthcare system. And how some of the ideals that the profession has kind of really constricts what we can say too. And you know, it illuminates some of those more pernicious aspects of like of the medical profession and the quote unquote professionalism behind it.
Yeah, that makes me think. What worries do you maybe have about being a doctor in a society that we've seen witnesses capital and war, you know, financially over care and well-being? We've seen the privatization of medical care turn medicine and medical professionals into this conservative force, like you said, where it's taboo to speak out for an event that's mass disabling event, an event where we're seeing increasing rates of treatable diseases because of the IDF releasing sewage into Gaza. We're seeing so many things that are absolutely relevant to medical professionals, and that medical professionals, if you're here for care of people, that you should absolutely care about. So what kind of worries you maybe about the way you've seen doctors turn on or not respond to Gaza?
Yeah, I think there's a couple of different levels of it. You know, there are physicians, you know, physicians in the US are generally pretty well compensated. That's a whole other discussion, right? Is like how you go from a medical student, how you take out hundreds of thousands of dollars of loans to a resident working, you know, 80-hour weeks for roughly $10 to $15 an hour to then like a physician where, you know, you join probably like the top 10% of earners in the country, right? That's a whole other conversation. But at the end of the day, physicians who are established are pretty well compensated. And you know, physicians are generally interested in the well-being of their patients, but they're also invested in the maintenance of their own social authority, their financial standing in the country and whatnot. And so standing up against things like militarism and militarist capitalism, you know, standing up against the incentives for profit within healthcare, this is not a popular position to take, even amongst physicians sometimes, because there are so many physicians who feel that, you know, I've worked so hard, I ought to, you know, be compensated, like make $500,000 a year or whatever, right? And in the same vein, I think there are probably a lot of physicians who see young people, young medical professionals, standing up in this moment, you know, advocating for Gaza, supporting the liberation of Palestine. And a lot of these physicians might take issue with that. and just be supporting genocide, right? A lot of physicians are very conservative. So that's the first thing that's scary. The second thing I think is kind of what we were talking about a few minutes ago, just a more general sense that as a medical professional, you shouldn't take a stance on topics that are quote unquote controversial. And if you do, then you compromise, you know, the kind of scientific authority that you have as a medical professional, because you start to introduce things like bias, right? You become opinionated, right? But at the same time, I think there's been a shift in medicine. You know, most everybody has the lingo now of social determinants of health, right? And I think that is beginning to be incorporated into medical education. But you see what's happening in Gaza, and you think about the development of weapons and military technology, right? Like, I remember around a couple months ago, I remember there was a lot of information being disseminated about like some of the bombs that were being used, right? Like bombs that shoot out like metal blades in all directions upon detonation. And this is like stuff that you hear that and it's almost cartoonish, but it's real, and it's like it's horrifying. I don't know. And so on the one hand, we're going to talk about social determinants of health, but what is a greater determinant of one's health than, you know, bombs being dropped over one's head, you know, being stuck under the rubble, not having water, not having a functioning sewage system, having sewage diverted towards your town because there's a settlement, you know, on higher ground next to you. These are all either physical determinants of health or at least social determinants of health. And I think anyone who takes seriously, you know, this move in medicine lately to consider social determinants of health has to consider the role of war, imperialism, and militarism. I think that's a push that has to be that me and others have to continue to make, is kind of just expanding the consciousness of physicians and expanding like what physicians understand as the scope of their concern, right? Because a patient can walk into the room and they might have diabetes or heart failure or any number of things that we think of as relating to the choices they make in their everyday life, right? And then you come to understand, okay, well, maybe this person lives in a food desert. Maybe this person is unemployed. Maybe this person is unhoused. But I think a lot of physicians still don't see changing those social conditions as a part of their position. Yeah. I think, right, what I would love for medicine to do and for us as physicians to imagine ourselves as is also treating those social conditions too. And then, you know, you go from something like a food desert to thinking about things like racial capitalism, to thinking about things like militarism and settler colonialism. And then at that level, the interventions become less clear as individuals, but that's when, you know, we have to come together in terms of our community and to really imagine bigger solutions to these social ills, right? And, you know, I think about someone like so many great leaders were physicians too. Like I think of people like Frantz Fanon, Che Guevara, right? And I think of someone like Fanon, who was a psychiatrist. Yeah. Right. And you know, his thought is so important in moments like these. He really theorized anti-colonial resistance, the psychopathologies of white supremacy and colonialism and whatnot. And I really do think that how he came to those realizations was probably, you know, studying people, understanding like mental illness and understanding mental illness and then seeing the effects of colonialism on people and beginning to understand and conceptualize and develop a vocabulary for describing social illnesses, right, and social pathologies. So I really look up to Fanon as like a model of someone who took, you know, a physician's kind of position, but expanded that consciousness, that scope of diagnosis, and then the scope of treatment, right, in terms of conceptualizing anti-colonial resistance. So so, you know, there's a lot of pushback when you start speaking like this, especially as a young medical student, right? You've kind of like at that point left the hospital, you've left the medical school. But I think it's important if we're going to take, you know, illness seriously and the way that illness manifests in people's lives, illness, injury, ill health, like we have to consider those social conditions. And I think, you know, militarism is just such a huge force, and it's so obvious in moments like this that I think we have to talk about it. And it really disappoints me and hurts me when people who are physicians or in the medical space aren't thinking about it, because, you know, what could be more impactful on people's health, right?
Right. No, I really appreciate you keeping it real with us. I think you're absolutely right that what so many folks have been looking for to hear from doctors around the world is, how can you let your counterparts be slaughtered and not be outraged and not be moved to action, right? So I love what you brought up, is this concept of being a doctor of also social ills and actually caring about the ways that war is also a social determinant of health, right? The ways that the new weaponry and injuries that Israel has inflicted also matters for doctors around the world, right? So I'd love to hear, what do you understand to be global medical community and the responsibility there, particularly the relationship between Western doctors and then doctors in places like Gaza and Cuba and Yemen and Haiti? How are you conceptualizing that future global medical community, or what's lacking?
Yeah, well, you know, when we talk about global medical communities, the first thing that comes to mind for me is the field of global health, which has a pretty troubled history because a lot of it originated in, you know, colonialism. It was first called tropical health, which was that term kind of came from the fact that there were U.S. colonies that were in the tropical areas. So places like the Philippines, places like U.S., you know, like the U.S. being involved in places like Panama, in other places in Central America, in Cuba and whatnot. And so tropical health evolved to global health. And I think a lot of the infrastructure for the way that we talk about global medical communities today is still wrapped up in that kind of, in now like a neo-colonial structure of global health. And a lot of the global health organizations are ultimately Western organizations that are, you know, grounded in either American universities or in, you know, like philanthropic foundations and so
I
on.
I global health track once upon a time in undergrad. I remember that life and just being in those lectures and feeling very, felt like the Orient 101. It felt like Orientalism 101, you know, it felt like a lot of xenophobia 101, you know, very basic, like mythologizing of folks, and yeah, very, it still felt like tropical medicine 101. Absolutely. I definitely remember seeing that. I think, like, yeah, I appreciate you bringing that up. Sorry to interrupt.
Oh no, not at all. Yeah, it's very pervasive in the way that we think about health. You know, the way we talk about the people's the way we talk about how people make decisions about their bodies, about their, you know, hygiene and so on, it tends to be quite paternalistic. But that was really most obvious in you know, like early quote unquote global health efforts. But you know, so despite, you know, with that caveat being said about the global medical community, there's a lot of ways that, like, you know, physicians and other health professionals who are anti-colonial in their orientation and who push back against, you know, these paternalistic conceptions of a global medical community. There are other ways for us to connect, you know, social media, things like Twitter. You know, I think it's, and I know you've spoken to journalists or you were thinking of talking about to some journalists for this episode, but like, I think about the way that we've all developed parasocial relationships to, you know, Bissan and Mu'taz and these people and, these journalists in Gaza. And I think it's important for us to have physicians to also look up to and health workers to also look up to in the same way, to, you know, really as models and as inspiration for, like, how can we conceptualize medicine and practice medicine in an anti-colonial way, in a decolonial way. And you know, I think of people like Dr. Ghassan Abu Sitta, who's a surgeon from Palestine, and he's written a lot on health in Palestine. And, you know, any number of physicians who were writing out of Gaza who have been killed, like Dr. Hamam Alo. You know, I think we ought to uphold their work. We ought to find inspiration in their work. And I found a lot of meaning in connecting with people online and with my peers who are engaged in like sharing some of their work and reading that together and, you know, letting ourselves be moved by that.
Yeah, I really appreciate that. I think you're absolutely right that doctors, much like journalists, have really shown us what it means to stay with the people to the end, and to stand by the people and mean that. You know, again, not to idolize doctors and journalists having to work through their own genocide, but there is something to be taken as a challenge to those of us who are in such a dire crisis about how deeply are we committed to bringing about liberation through the professions that we're in, right? How deeply are we committed to staying by the ill and the sick and the socially ill? So yeah, I really appreciate that. I guess you started to talk about it a little bit, but I would love to hear about your experiences among American medical students. Have folks been organizing, discussing, kind of pushing back on the standard of the medical profession, or has it still felt like not quite a safe space? Or love to hear about kind of where you are now in your hopes for, you know, we've been thinking about risk and solidarity and what does it mean to kind of push the bounds of what we have, but also, you know, staying safe. So I'd love to hear from you about what you've witnessed among students lately.
Yeah. Well, before I answer that question, something that you said at the end of, you said a few seconds ago, made me think of a piece I read in Al Jazeera, I think, actually written by a former professor of my own. His name is Dr. Bram Wispelwe, co-authored with Eric Reinhardt. And these are both US-based physicians, but they wrote a piece called Care or Collaborationism, and they were writing about the situation in Gaza. And really what they argued was that as a medical professional, you know, we're seeing, kind of like you were saying, you know, Gazan physicians and other health workers, nurses and so on, standing with their patients to the end. And, you know, how much of that is really up to them is, like you said, it's like unclear, because if the IDF tells you that they're going to bomb your hospital and it's full of patients, like, what, you know, there's nothing really you can do. But we've seen such heroism by these physicians and a model of what true care looks like, right? And as physicians and medical students based in the US, like, you know, in the South, there's so many companies, I'm not, you know, trying to not get too specific, I guess, but in the South, there's so many companies that are tied to Israeli weapons manufacturing, tied to the military industrial complex. And these are here in our backyards, right? And as people living here, we have to begin to think about, you know, how can we let these things continue to operate? And if, as physicians, we're only concerned with the patient in front of us and not about, again, the social conditions that are shaping them, or about what's happening in Gaza, then we're ultimately just collaborators in what's happening, right? We're complicit in the genocide. And so I just wanted to talk about that for a second when you brought up like how Gazan physicians are really exemplifying the ethic of care. I think to even try to begin to strive for that, the first step we have to take as people practicing in the US is to stand against what's happening in Gaza. But then back to your question, you kind of asked, you know, what's it like being a medical student these days? My background is a little different than some medical students. You know, like I was in the humanities. I studied decolonial theory and history and politics and whatnot. And I think one thing that the medical profession kind of utilizes in a sense is the fact that to succeed as a student in medicine or a pre-medical student, you know, you're not rewarded by taking classes to learn about history or to learn about colonialism, right? Like you got to take your science, your organic chemistry, your physics and whatnot. And that means there's a lot of medical students who go through undergrad, go straight to medical school, who didn't have any formal education on, you know, on
humans as humans, not as biology.
Right, exactly. Humans as humans. And I think for medical students, that kind of engenders a type of passivity and like you said, an apoliticalness that is really deeply problematic. At the same time, you know, I think it's important to leverage our position as physicians and like these, you know, ideals or ethics that we claim to hold, like do no harm, you know, caring for everyone regardless of their background. I think the challenge for those of us who are engaged is to try and leverage those principles and those ideals to try and raise consciousness and move other folks to action. There's a lot of interesting figures who have pushed back against these aspects of medical education too, where it's like, you know, you're rewarded by kind of being silent or whatever. There's a physician who goes by the name of Bernie Lim, I think is her name. And she started a clinic in Oakland called the Freedom Community Clinic, I want to say is it's called. And she just decided to not apply for residency at all. And she was like, you know, the medical education and medical professional system in the US is fundamentally capitalistic. It doesn't really nurture us as young medical professionals in the way that we need. And she was like, I'm just going to do my own thing. I'm going to just have my community clinic. You know, the intricacies of what that took, I'm not really sure, but you know, to me that's something that I think is really cool. And for me personally, I ultimately just want to practice with people, you know, I want to be in the community. I want to work with people who need it most. And you know, I know I can't do that. And I can't center, you know, working with the working class, you know, with minority populations and so on. And thinking about their care, I can't do that without thinking about what's happening in Gaza too. And so I know that I just have to be in places where I can continue to you know, use my voice because, you know, it's too important to not speak up right now. Yeah.
Yeah, that's so powerful. I really appreciate that. I think you cover so many really amazing things around responsibility, solidarity, risk, humanism, you know, what it means to really care about people, about care, about illness, and everything that stands for, that you must stand for, and not prioritizing professionalism or appearance over people and over Palestinians. So we really appreciate learning so much from you today, Bilal. Thank you so much for joining us.
That's all, folks. Thank you for listening to Code Pink Radio, presented by WBAI in New York City, WPFW in Washington, D.C., KPFT in Houston, and KPFK 90.7 FM, Los Angeles. Till peace is ours.
Together. Daddy Bush knows the Carlyle Group since years before been raking in billions and itching for more.
It's blood for oil, we know there's a link.
They say code war,
we say code pink.
It's blood for oil, we know there's a link. They say code war,
we say code pink.
Code pink for freedom, code pink for peace, code pink to hunger. When our enemy was not Iraq, but Iran.
They feed you lies, don't want you to think.
They say code terror,
we say code pink.
They feed you lies, don't want you to think. They say code terror,
we say code pink.
Code pink for freedom, code pink for peace, code pink till hunger and war have ceased. Code pink for women, boys, men, and girls. Together we'll our phones and the places we meet. They curtail our speech, our movement, our rights, but we won't give up.
We're about to fight.
With the wave of the flag, our liberty shrink. They say code fear,
we say code pain.
With the wave of the flag, our liberty shrink. They say code fear,
we say code pain.
Code pain for freedom, code pain for peace, code pain to hunger.
Pink.
And they
Coachella.
We say Code Pink.
And they say Code War.
We say Code Pink.
Well, they say Code Howell.
We say Code Pink.
And they say Code Brumsville.
We say Code.